And what I wanted was unity. What I wanted was brotherhood. What I wanted was somewhere to fit in, somewhere to be myself.
Sense of community.
Right.
So you were in search of something.
Yeah.
And what that ultimately led you to was ISIS.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Etched Communication, a full-service public relations and crisis management firm. Connect with Etched via their website at etchedcom.com. That's etchedcomm.com.
My guest today is a young man named Asher Khan, who has a cautionary tale that he would like to share, and he wants others to have the benefit of his experience and perhaps learn something that will keep them from perhaps going down the wrong track. So, Asher, I really appreciate you being here to talk with us today. You have had a very difficult last 5 or 6 years. Tell our audience how and when that started.
Well, it actually started early on, if you think about, or if you consider like the mindset itself, like early and late middle school, I guess, like, you know, I grew up in a very traditional family. My parents were very traditional people. They revered the Pakistani culture, and, you know, and they expected us, me and my brothers, to live up to that culture. So, and we didn't have a problem with that. You know, it was interesting, right? The issue came, though, is like whenever I went to school and my friends, they didn't live that culture. They lived a completely different culture, you know, American culture.
So let's tell everybody that the school is a Houston area high school. And what's the name of the school?
So my middle school's name was Krimmel Intermediate.
Okay. And then you went on to?
To Klein Oaks High School.
Klein Oaks High School.
Yeah.
Okay. In the Houston area. So go ahead.
Yeah. So this was a public school, you know. Klein Oaks was actually an IB league school. So, and I was actually doing pre-IB. And so my friends, even though that my friends, a lot of them were Pakistani, like they just, like the culture around us was very American. It was a public school, right? So, and it was difficult because whenever I was with my friends, they couldn't connect to the Pakistani, like personality of mine that I was expected to have at home. So I had to just kind of fit in with them and develop this new personality, right? Like, you know, when I say personality, I'm talking about like, the way you talk, your jokes, you know, the mm-hmm. conversations that you have, the things that you find interesting even.
So you're basically navigating two worlds. You're fitting in at home the way your parents wanted you to embrace your Pakistani culture.
Right.
And then you go to school and you're trying to fit in with your American friends.
Right, right. And, this clash really led me to feel like alienated. You know, it stripped me of an identity. Like I eventually started to wonder, like, what am I at the end of the day? You know, am I a Pakistani? Am I an American? You know, or am I just like, you know, pretending with my parents and pretending with my friends and I'm somebody totally different? Like, I kind of went through an identity crisis, I guess you could call it.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I guess, made me very vulnerable. So I wanted to find identity in a sense, right? And I happened to turn to religion for that. And I wasn't, you know, my parents weren't very religious. I didn't know where to turn to religion. So I turned to the internet. And
what did you find?
So, you know, the internet's a huge place, right? You can find a variety of things. You know, I tend, whenever the searches I made and whatnot, I found stuff that was, post 9/11 rhetoric, basically, you know?
So extremist violent sort of rhetoric that you were seeing.
Right, right. So it was very, I wouldn't say it was violent, but it was like extremist propaganda.
Okay.
Right? Like they would look for any opportunity to, you know, deem a leader of any country like a leader that should be overthrown. You know, and then they use this call of unity, which was my appealing factor, right? since I was having an identity crisis, this call for unity really reeled me in, right? And so every other call that they were making, like rebelling against a leader or certain fighting methods that are justified or whatnot, mm-hmm. like that stuff, you know, I had my morality to judge, but like what was right and wrong, but I would overlook or not even overlook, but like think that none of that is even true in the face of what I wanted. And what I wanted was unity. What I wanted was brotherhood. What I wanted was somewhere to fit in, somewhere to be myself.
Sense of community.
Right.
So you were in search of something.
Yeah.
And what that ultimately led you to was ISIS.
Yeah. So ISIS, you know, back in 2014, they were a new group. So they really emphasized this call for unity. And, you know, by this time I had moved to Australia because me and my family had like, we were feeling a lack of family here in the US and we had family in Australia. So our goal was to eventually go over there and settle down mm-hmm. with my uncle there. But so I went over there to learn, I was trying to get a degree in accounting, but I thought going over there would make me feel less isolated because I was with family. But I guess in a sense that was counteractive because I got so busy over there. I was going to school and working. I felt even more isolated.
You know? So you ended up taking that isolation. And what was the next step there?
Well, the next step was I needed to find some kind of community. And I guess like the vacuum of ISIS created that for me. You know, there was the Syrian dictator, Bashar al-Assad, he chemically bombed his own people. And social media was flooded with pictures and this like of little kids gasping for air, babies freezing. And that created this emotional thing for me. And, you know, I felt like that was my purpose. I found purpose in that.
Your purpose was to join ISIS and go fight Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah. So I found purpose in that. I felt like this was the only way to bring stability and bring unity, you know, amongst the Muslims in the Middle East, essentially. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, what did you do?
I reached out to a friend who in Houston who I knew to be very sympathetic towards what was happening in the Middle East as well, with the children and all of the genocide, really. And I reached out to him and I told him what I wanted to go there and join. And he jumped on board. And I guess that was like an encouraging factor for me as well. And we both ended up, you know, just planning to take a flight. And we ended up taking a flight to Turkey.
So your plan was to go to Turkey and then to Syria to join ISIS.
Yeah.
And you ended up coming back to Houston mm-hmm. before you were able to complete that mm-hmm. act.
Yeah.
When you think back in terms of what was going on in your mind, mm-hmm. when you got on a plane and you flew from Australia mm-hmm. to Turkey with the intent of going to Syria and joining ISIS, did you have a second thought? Did you think, I'm getting ready to go join a terrorist organization that does horrific things to people? Mm-hmm. What was going through your mind?
So looking back now, like, I think it's crazy because when somebody has made up their mind about something, they'll refuse to believe anything that conflicts with it. You know, so all of the horrific things that ISIS was doing and, you know, that was on the media of them doing, like, I refuse to even believe it. I refuse to believe that, you know, anything that's ascribed to them that I don't agree with, that they're actually doing it. I thought, like, they were being lied against, like, when
so you believed the propaganda, the highly produced, very slick films that were showing the brotherhood and the sense of belonging.
Yes. And they were very well produced videos, right? And anything that I saw on CNN or BBC or any other, you know, national media outlet that, you know, brought forth like their other side, I refuse to believe it. I'm like, no, this is not what they're doing. It can't be because they're doing this. And I saw their videos, right? So even though it's so obvious, because how can so many people lie about something? So, but I was so close-minded about it. Now, when I got on that plane, honestly, like as soon as I sat down on that plane, I knew that I was being impulsive, right? I was being very impulsive, but, and I honestly wanted to get off the plane deep down inside. Thoughts though led me to not, because I felt like if I got off now, you know, I had already spent so much money. And now if I go back to my, I left a note with my uncle, I sent a text to my brother and I just turned off my phone. I was afraid of the backlash that I would get from my parents.
And then ultimately your parents created a ruse to get you back by telling you that your mother was ill and you needed to return home.
Yeah.
And so that was enough to get you to turn around and fly back home.
Yeah.
But your friend did not. Mm-hmm. What happened to him?
I told him I wanted to go back. And I told him why. I was honestly looking for any excuse to go back. And I offered him, like, you should come back with me. He was very adamant about his purpose, though. Like, he's like, no, this is something I really want to do. He also left a note with his mother. I believe he told her that he was going to study abroad. But he didn't want to come back. And
ultimately, what happened to him?
So according to what the government has said, that his mom received a message from his Facebook saying that he died fighting the Syrian dictator, Bashar al-Assad.
So your friend, you are told, died fighting with ISIS. And you came back to the States, enrolled in school. You currently are a student at the University of Houston.
Yes.
Studying
mechanical engineering technology.
Obviously, you're a very bright young man. But when you came back, you were in school, and then one day the FBI knocked on your door.
Yeah.
About a year later.
Yeah. So about 15 months later, after I had come back, I got a bang on my door by the FBI. You know, I wasn't expecting any of it. I was very scared. Honestly, even when I realized, at first I thought I was being robbed, but even when I realized it was the FBI, I had no idea, like, because I had put all of this behind me. I didn't even realize that that's something that would come back to me.
But it not only came back to you, it put you in prison.
Yes, it hit me hard.
How long were you in prison and what were you convicted of?
They charged me with providing material support to a terrorist organization. And they said that, I had a hand in providing my friend. So that's what I was convicted of. And my judge sentenced me to 18 months in prison.
18 months in prison, which apparently was a rather light sentence for the type of crime that you were convicted of.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so now what is happening?
So yeah, essentially I was looking at 15 years, maximum 15 years in prison, a lifetime of surveillance when I got out.
I didn't understand that. What did you say? A lifetime of surveillance money? I don't understand.
A lifetime of surveillance when I get out. So basically a lifetime of probation.
Okay, right? I understand.
The judge gave me 18 months. The government didn't agree.
Which you served and the government didn't agree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I served. My sentence actually ends on the 26th of this month, so 26th of November. The government didn't agree. The government thought that the sentence was too low. I should have got more time. So they appealed the case, and the Court of Appeals, I think the Fifth Circuit, they turned it around. So essentially I'm back in front of the judge again for resentencing.
And that is about a couple weeks away.
That's a few weeks away, yes, December.
Yeah. So the government is now appealing the previous sentence, and you once again could be facing 15 years behind bars.
Right, and that's what they're asking for. They want 15 years behind bars.
Why are you doing this interview? What is it that you want people to know and understand about your journey? I started this by saying you have a cautionary tale to share. Why are you sharing it?
I feel like a very unique experience. I feel like the route I went down, I feel like it was more of a victimized route. I feel like I fell into propaganda. I feel like I was feeling certain ways that a lot of youth also feel. You know, the feeling of isolation and alienation is very common. You know, and what that does, it opens the door to a lot of different routes potentially, right? So depending on what somebody is exposed to at the early stages of those feelings, that essentially leads them down to whatever route they're going to take. You know, it's very important, I feel like, that young men and women, whoever feel or having those feelings, that they're equipped with, you know, the knowledge to know what to do when they're having those feelings. You know, the last thing I want is, because I know how much this ruined my life. I know how much, you know, and it potentially could ruin it even more. And the last thing I want is someone else to, you know, go down the same road, basically. You know, and there's a lot you could say about, you know, how one is feeling and what one should do when they're feeling, you know, some kind of isolation or loneliness even. You know, loneliness is very common, and it could also lead down routes like this as well.
What is your message to parents? Mm-hmm. You grew up in a household with two loving parents,
yeah,
and siblings and a very close family. And yet you were going through something that your parents apparently did not recognize,
yeah,
in such a way that they were able to help you get through it.
Yeah.
So what can you say to other parents out there as they are raising their children to help them spot the signs that something is not quite right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is something I'm very passionate about. I wish I could reach every parent in the world, honestly, about this specific issue. But so when a child, I specifically, when I was searching for purpose, when I was lonely and I wanted to fit in somewhere, you know, people tend to attach themselves to something that appeals to them. And in my case, it was religion. You know, in some people's cases, it could be video games. In other people's cases, it could be a gang. In other people's cases, it could be anything that they attach their purpose to, right? Or they find meaning in. Now, the worst thing, in my opinion, a parent could do at this stage is outright tell them no and turn them away from it. Because they have already attached themselves to this. And signs that parents can use to see like where their child is at, if they see unusual or like over interest in something, a particular aspect, like they've been playing video games more than they usually do, right? They spend a lot of time doing it. They've been studying a specific subject more than they usually do. You know, some people even find, you know, their purpose in activism. So it could be good and it could be bad, you know? But the worst thing parents can do is just outright say no and turn them away from it. The best thing parents can do is get themselves involved in that subject, you know, and then use that to guide their children, right? Because what that does, children see their parents as a friend rather than authority figure.
So in your case, you started searching to understand more about your faith, mm-hmm, about Islam.
Yeah.
And your parents took that. How did your parents take that? Let me ask you. How did they take that?
Yeah. So in this Pakistani culture, if someone turns to faith, then it's usually because they're not succeeding in the world, you know, in worldly matters like your education and stuff like that. So they just, you know, they turned to faith as like a backup thing. And I guess my parents, when they noticed that I was turning to faith, they essentially took that as, you know, I don't want to focus on my studies. You know, I've essentially given up on going to university or whatnot. So they felt scared, and they felt like pushing me away from the faith or limiting my interest in faith will keep me focused in school. You know, and I didn't think that that's something that was,
But that wasn't really the reason that you were turning away, that you were searching for your faith.
Right. That wasn't the reason at all.
Right. Have you had conversation with your parents about that? Have you explain to them? Do they understand how things might have turned out a bit differently if they had been able to take that walk with you?
Yeah. So I've talked to them about it. They do understand my perspective. It's still a sensitive topic just because they've also feel like I've betrayed them and that they feel hurt. So me kind of bringing it up, like, it makes them feel like, oh, you're just blaming us, like it's our fault. And, you know, it's not their fault completely. You know, it's you know, it takes two hands to clap. So it was just a situation, you know, what happened. I feel like they could have taken measures that would have prevented me. I feel like if they really understood, you know why I was doing it. But that's my fault too, because I never told them. I told them out of fear. I brought it up, or I pushed it a little bit. And whenever I said that I was feeling lonely and I wanted to spend more time, I wanted to fit in, my parents took that essentially, because both of my parents were full-time workers, right? They were working full-time. And they took that as a threat, or they took that personally, and they said, you know, we're working because we need to provide for you. You know, if we just took time off, then how are we going to pay the bills?
Yeah.
So they also took that like I'm blaming them, you know, for my loneliness and whatnot. So.
And it's really not a case of blame. It's just, it's heartbreaking to hear this, because obviously your parents love you,
yeah,
and your brothers, and they were providing for you in the best way that they knew how.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, so much of your story is about understanding when it's okay to reach out for help. It's about communicating,
yeah,
and talking things through, not being afraid to ask for help. What are the lessons, do you think, of your story that you really want everyone to understand?
I want everyone to understand that you can't figure things out on your own. You have to go and talk to people. You have to go talk, especially your family. Like, no matter how, like, if you feel like your parents aren't going to understand, you feel like, you know, they're pushing you away, even then, just tell them seriously. Because, you know, parents, they want best for their child, but they think that they know best. And sometimes they don't, right? Sometimes they just don't understand something. So, but I feel like a child should just push it. And I understand that there are cases where, you know, a parent is not the best person to talk to. You know, some people are just, you know, raised up in a family like that. But there's so many resources out there. There's counselors, there's teachers. I feel like reaching out to someone and expressing your honest feelings without worried of a backlash is essential. It's important. You have to do it. I thought that I could just navigate my feelings for myself. And, you know, now that I look back at that, like, I don't understand why I even did that, because, you know, there are people, and, you know, I say this a lot, human being psychology is the same. We feel like our elders don't understand us. But what we fail to understand, and this is a message to the youth, what we fail to understand is that our elders were once youth as well. You know, and society may change, but human psychology doesn't change. You know, and all human beings, you know, they think similarly. So our elders, our parents, when they were youth, they thought like us. So they know how to navigate this. They know, you know. So.
And all human beings have an innate need to feel connected and a sense of belonging and a sense of community.
Yeah.
And that's what you went in search of.
Yeah.
And you found it in the wrong place.
I found it in the wrong place. And there's, you know, people are just waiting. People are out there waiting to just feed on people looking for purpose. You know, people understand this. People understand that there's youth out there that are looking for purpose. And their whole propaganda is just comprised of reaching out to that specific group of people and try to recruit as much as they can. And I felt like I was a victim of that. You know, so, and this is my purpose of sharing my story. It's like I can reach as many ears as I can to, especially youth and parents, you know.
Are you afraid of what might happen when your hearing comes up in the next few weeks?
I am afraid. This has been going on for a while now. You know, the most difficult part of it is that, like, I felt like I was done with it once I was sentenced to 18 months. So I felt like I could now plan for my future. I felt like I could, you know, everything would fall into place now. I could start working towards my future again. But
you're in the middle of finals, right?
Right. So right now I have finals. I have one more semester left for my degree. And now this came back up, you know, and once again, it's difficult for me to plan for the future when I don't know what's at stake, when I don't know like what's going to happen. You know, there's a lot at stake. Essentially, like half of my life is at stake. So I'm afraid.
You're 25 now.
I'm 25 years old. Yeah.
When you think about your future, if let's say the sentencing is either very light or doesn't happen at all, mm-hmm. that they decide to let you go with time served.
Yeah.
What would your life look like? What do you allow yourself to dream?
Mm-hmm. I want to get a job, right? I want to start a family. That's something I really look forward to doing. You know, I want a family of my own. I think I have a very unique experience, and I want to use this to essentially just my entire life. This is something that's with me now, and I feel like I want to use it the best way I can, and you know, speak out, try to reach as many ears as I can. Essentially just live a normal life. You know, I want to put all of this behind me. I don't want people looking at me in a certain way, you know.
But you know that as you say, that is going to be with you for your entire life.
Yeah.
That's a daunting thing to know mm-hmm. and to understand. How do you deal with that psychologically?
I have a lot of friends and family that are supportive. You know, so that's a great factor that helps me a lot. So just surrounding yourself with people, because like for every person that's going to look at you weirdly or awkwardly, for every employer that's going to just shut you off because of what they see, there's always that other person, there's always that other employer that's willing to give you a chance, that's willing to hear it out, that's willing to put themselves in your shoes and understand where you're coming from. I don't let all the negativity influence me, because I just focus on the positive side, and there's always positives.
If you could turn back time.
Oh, if only, right?
If only, right?
Yeah.
If you could turn back time to that moment when you made the decision to get on that plane, what would you do?
I can still feel that feeling I had when I turned off my phone, and I knew like all I wanted right now is just to get off. But there were so many excuses I was giving myself as to like all the backlash I'm gonna face with my family. I paid so much for this. I don't even have enough money to enroll back into school again, pay for classes. I wish I just didn't let that deter my want to get off. But like I wish I just had got off, and I wasn't thinking, that was the issue. I was letting all these feelings cloud my judgment. Had I just thought about it, you know, I really wish I just got off that plane when I knew my heart wanted me to.
Yeah. And that you had reached out for help.
Yeah, that I reached out. That I just told my parents what was going on in my mind.
Yeah.
I told my uncle in Australia. They all would have understood. You know, they all would have, maybe not initially, but had I pushed like, this is a serious issue, you need to help me, I know they would have. No, I wish I'd just done that.
And that's the reason that we're having this conversation today, so that young people who are out there listening and watching, whatever it is that you're going through, there's someone out there who can help you through it. You don't want to go down a path that's going to lead you toward a negative outcome.
Yeah.
There's always a way, and there's somebody out there to help.
Yeah.
Asher, we wish you the best. I wish you the best. I know there are some people who will be watching and listening to this and who might not mm-hmm. wish that for you, because they look at what you did, where you almost landed,
mm-hmm.
but someone that you were involved with lost his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this is something you're going to live with, obviously, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't given you a chance to say?
It's an unfortunate situation. You know, I really hope everything works out in terms of this sentence, but this just goes to show, like, this stuff is not trivial. It's a very serious matter. You know, no. Your whole life is...
It's life. Yeah. It's about life. Yeah. It's about life. Okay. Asher, thank you very much. Thank all of you for giving Asher permission to speak and for having the courage to listen, I hope, with an open mind, and that you will take the lessons that he has shared with us to heart and use them in your own lives. We'll see you next time.